Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called From the Cradle to the Court. A very special guest, child death investigator, Lisa Mayhew. So now, without any further ado, here are your hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome everyone to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. And we are thrilled to have Lisa Mayhew with us today. She is the child death investigator and trainer for the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner in the state of North Carolina. And she has been doing this since 2000, conducting investigation of child deaths throughout the state, providing assistance in investigations to local and state agencies. And she's also developed a child death investigation training program together with the North Carolina Justice Academy. And they offer trainings across the state, and she trains throughout the U.S. She's also the author of Child Death Investigations, Interdisciplinary Techniques from Cradle to Court, and that's available through Carolina Academic Press. Welcome, Lisa. We are so pleased to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, tell us about your background. This doesn't seem like something people go to school saying, you know what, I want to become a child death investigator. So did you always plan on working for the ME's office, or how did you become a part of this whole field?
Oh, I think I just stumbled on it, and I think it was completely fate. My background's child development, so I had been doing training and consultation in North Carolina and across the country with some therapists and professionals that work with special needs kids and developing programs for them. And it was grant money, soft money, so wanted something more permanent and came across this position. It was brand new. No one had really ever done the position before. Was created as part of the North Carolina Child Fatality System, and they needed somebody who could do the training and the consulting, but also do the investigative piece, and I had a little bit of the medical background with the special needs and medically fragile kids, and so they just spent a year sending me all over the country getting me trained on the pathological stuff and investigative aspects, so it just came together perfect, and I'm where I need to be.
Well, that's always good when you enjoy your job, even as gruesome as it can be sometimes. Every state obviously is different and have different ways of doing things. And tell us a little bit about the basic structure of how it works in North Carolina with the medical death investigation team. How is it How is it organized?
Well, we have a chief medical examiner system, so we have a statewide system. Our main office is in Raleigh, and that's where I'm at. That's where I'm based out of, is the Raleigh office. We have regional, kind of informal regional facilities in three other areas of the state with forensic pathologists and everything there. It's very similar to Virginia's system. It's just not as formalized as Virginia's system. We're working on trying to get there, but requires magic money trees and things like that and funding, which is difficult to obtain. But essentially, the death investigators are based at most of those regional facilities. We have myself and then two others at our office, and the other two handle the adult cases. And so we go out on a local basis. We serve about 25 counties right around us. And so we can go out to scenes. We service the counties right around us, but we have jurisdiction in all 100 counties. So we can be called out to assist pretty much anywhere. And you know, we have our full tox lab and everything at our office, which services the entire state. So all tox comes through us. What we also do in North Carolina is our pathologists in our office do their cases in our office, but they also review the work that's done at the regional facility. So every case will come through our office for review and investigation to a certain degree. So we actually see everything that happens in the state in our office.
Well, what exactly, you know, you told us about who does this, but who, when you go out for a death investigation as a death investigator, what steps do you take? What exactly do you do on scene? I know it's an orchestrated effort in these crime scenes that different parts of the forensic team come in and do things. What exactly do you do there?
Typically law enforcement calls us, tells us what they have going on, and we respond. With the child cases, with particularly with the infants, one of my main things is to typically do a reconstruction with the family while we have them there. Or if we're not going to do a reconstruction, or we don't need to do a reconstruction for whatever purpose, I'll talk to the family, try to get as much detail as I possibly can. You know, again, this is going to be at the home typically, or possibly at the emergency room where emotions are extremely high. So we just try to get as much detail as we possibly can, get them to walk us through exactly what happened. We explain the processes to them, what's going to happen, you know, that there's going to be an autopsy. One thing I always try to reiterate with families is to pick a funeral home, because it's just not on their to-do list. And in order for everything to kind of flow properly, they have to pick that funeral home so that the funeral home can pick up the bodies and things like that. But, you know, just mainly just to kind of be a face for our office, kind of let them know exactly what's going to happen, what kind of information that we need, and most importantly, that we are all going to do everything that we can to try to figure out exactly what happened to their child. So I make sure I leave them my information. We'll take photos. And then if there's anything the family needs beyond that, they know that they can contact me.
So I know this varies tremendously from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, especially state to state, that you can have everything from zero training to needing to be a board certified member of NAME. But for death investigators in North Carolina, what kind of training is required?
I believe everybody that in our state, we go through the St. Louis School. That's the primary one that most folks go through. There's others around the country, but St. Louis holds a basic medical legal death course. I don't even know how many times a year they hold it now. I went through it back in 2000, and all of our investigators went through that. Actually, one of our new investigators went through a program in New England, but there's several basic programs that you can go through. And then there is the board certification process. We're actually preparing to go through that right now at our office, and that's through the ABMDI, the American Board of Medical Legal Death Investigators. So we're getting ready to sit for those boards and take exams and all that good fun stuff. But I think the basic knowledge, I think, is the same, but depending on the system that you're in, the function of a death investigator can vary extremely widely. So it just really kind of depends on the system that you're in, because we're a state system. Our medical examiners don't necessarily go to scenes. It's not a requirement. So law enforcement handles our scenes for us. If you go to a county system, your death investigator and MEs are always at the scenes, or typically at scenes, and handle it that way. So it really kind of just depends on what state and what system you're in.
So what do you wish the public better understood about death investigation?
That it's not done in 45 minutes.
It's actually 42 minutes of screen time, but yeah.
You know,
but
I mean,
it would be great if you got the budget from those commercials, right?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, my dream would be to have the anagram that they used to have on CSI New York, where you just touched the air and like a screen popped up above the body. We didn't have that in our budget, I'm told. But I think what the general public needs to understand is that all of the answers do not come flowing out from the basic autopsy. Yeah, the basic autopsy is one piece, and our end, our investigation is just one piece of the puzzle. So you've got to combine so much information to get a full investigation done. It's not just what a forensic pathologist can do. It's what the forensic pathologist can do, and then what does law enforcement provide? What does social services provide? What did EMS see when they were at the scene for all of 10 seconds? What did they hear? So it's putting, it's like, you know, it's like the spokes of a wheel, and every single spoke has got to be there in order for that death to be put in the proper context. And that takes time. And, you know, we get complaints, you know, we don't have a report, and it's 2 months since my loved one died. And it's like, you know, it takes time to pull all that information together, to gather the medical records, and to go through and make sure that we are assigning the most accurate cause and manner of death to this person, to this decedent. And so I think, you know, that would be my big wish is that, and I reiterate that with families. I'm like, you know, we may have preliminary tomorrow, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to, you know, we may not have final results for at least a couple more months.
Well, you mentioned earlier, you know, that your degrees and interests and all that was in child development and all that, and then obviously the forensic science bug bit you pretty hard.
Yeah.
And then you moved into this, and but I got to think that there might be more for why you when you got into the forensic world that you gravitated to child deaths, which is not something that the average person, and I got to think it's probably more than just the fact that you have a degree in child development. What was it that struck you about the need for someone to be in this arena of death investigation?
You know, I don't even know if it's just one thing or if it's the whole package, because to me, I work as much for the families as I do the state of North Carolina. And that's kind of where my heart and soul was before, with working with families who had special needs kids or medically fragile kids, and really kind of being that person who kind of helped them get through the system, help them with their child, help them navigate the, you know, therapies and different things. And that's a lot of what I do with this job, is kind of doing a little hand-holding with the families, making sure that they get what they need, we get what we need. And, you know, I mean, people laugh at me because I tell them I like doing the reconstructions. It makes other people's skin crawl, but I like doing the reconstructions because it gives me that time with the families to just kind of take a deep breath, go through everything, and give them as much assurance as I possibly can. So that was probably, whether it was conscious or not, that was probably part of the big pull for me.
Great answer.
Well, the subject of death itself is one that many people can't handle. In fact, I think that's really behind a lot of the underfunding of coroners and medical examiners' offices. But when we start to talk about the deaths of children, we're nearly into, I think, taboo territory for a lot of people. Writers of crime fiction are often told never write about the two things you're never supposed to do are kill a child or a pet. So you're never to write about the death of a child, and yet children do die, and sometimes violently. So what kinds of problems do you think are created by our unwillingness to talk about children dying, you know, before their time, as any of us would think of it?
I think that the biggest issue is it makes messaging very difficult. It makes prevention very difficult because people don't want to hear the bad things that can happen. But unfortunately, I'm a realist. I'm not a cynic. I am a realist. You know, this stuff just happens, and we have to deal with it. We have to confront it. We have to try to save some of these kids from dying. And it's very hard to do if the general public shuns it and, oh, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to see that. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the Super Bowl, and I forget what the ad was for. I don't know if it was an insurance ad or something, but they had the little boy on the ad who turned out to be dead in the ad and nobody could see him.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an uproar about it. People were totally offended by that. And it was a pretty mild message.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes trying to develop PSAs, it makes trying to develop print materials to put out there to prevent future deaths difficult, because you've got to make sure that your message is straightforward, but that, you know, you don't offend the masses. And, you know, sometimes in my world, sometimes people just need to be smacked upside the head with the 2x4 to get them to get the message. And it's just in this particular area, it's extremely hard to do without setting people off.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, to me, that's the hard thing. And it is real. It's real. We know that kids die, but no one wants to think that it could ever happen to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I think at one point I remember talking to you that even among those in-depth investigations, you have people who shy away from child death investigation.
Oh, absolutely. We have detectives who don't like to come to child autopsies. We'll have, I mean, in 15 years, I've worked with a bunch of detectives that they worked one case, and one child case was all it took to get them to transfer back out to patrol. They did not want to deal with those kinds of cases. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I understand it. It's human nature. I think there's just some people are going to be very good and devoted and will do very well at it, and it will always bother other people.
So all of this said, how do you personally handle the emotional consequences of the work?
In a myriad of ways. I'm a very happy, upbeat person. So when it does creep up on me, I get quiet, or I will have a little crying bout. So it definitely, I'm not unaffected by my work.
Mm-hmm.
I find that at this point in my career, it sneaks up on me very unexpectedly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can't cry at work. I can't do so. My body will, like, if the ASPCA commercials come on the television, I will bawl like a baby. You know, I'll cry over I'll cry over weird things,
mm-hmm.
but I can't cry about work, you know. So I come home, and I've got my animals. I ride horses. I've taken up, at the age of 45, taken up dressage lessons, so that is phenomenal. And I've got my dogs, and I'm learning how to train my dog for competition, and we do a little cadaver work. So, you know, your animals absorb a lot of your stress, and they don't really care if your day has been bad. You know, they just feed us, work us, you know, get over yourself and play with us, kind of, you know. So it's nice that you can I try very hard at the end of my day not to bring the rest of it home with me, and to separate my personal life and my professional life, because otherwise I think it would just eat me alive.
Mm.
Well, continuing down that vein, obviously there are some the good, the bad, and the ugly in your job, as
mm-hmm.
there are in any of these jobs in this arena. What's the best part? What do you enjoy the most? What gives you the most joy and, you know, makes you smile when you go to bed at night? And what makes you lay awake at night and say, Lord, why am I doing this?
Oh, gosh. You know what? I think that's probably the easiest question to answer. I think the most fulfilling part for me is giving the family the answers that they want and having that honest conversation with them. One of my favorite people in the world was a grandmother that I did the reconstruction with on her grandson's death, and I see her to this day. That was, I don't know, back in 2008, and she will hug me. We gave her the best gift that we could give her, and that was answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, however we get to those answers, it's just a huge thing for me. And we, you know, we've had some really kind of off the wall cases this year that really took phenomenal work by the pathologists and by everybody, the detectives and everybody, to really come to a final conclusion on it. and being able to call the family and say, okay, here's what's happening. And they're just, they're tickled to death to get an answer. They don't like the unknowns. And, you know, a lot of them don't like that. They don't want to hear you say SIDS. They're like, tell me you don't know how my child died, but don't give me, you know, this, don't give me some cock and bull thing about SIDS. I don't want to see it. And then I think the hardest part is systems issues, the agencies, how, you know, having system failures wherever it may be that led to an investigation getting compromised or that led to a death itself. That's what infuriates me. And having to deal with people who just don't appreciate the importance of these types of investigations. It will make me very angry.
Well,
right? Angry Lisa writes letters to people.
Well, if it offers any salve, the same thing's going on in medicine right now. So,
yes.
So, and getting worse every day. Well, let's drill down into some of the nuts and bolts of your profession. What are the leading causes of child deaths and some of the ways that, you know, a lot of our listeners may not know exactly what we're talking about here. You know, they're thinking of bad things or accidental things, but what are the leading causes of child deaths and what are some of the ways that these can be prevented?
Well, I think that's a great question because I do think people are under the impression that the coroners or the medical examiners only deal with the really bad stuff. And the reality is most of the deaths that we see are naturals and accidentals. So that's going to be your SIDS cases. That's going to be your bronchopneumonia, your infections, your myocarditis, congenital heart defects that nobody knew existed, accidental drownings, motor vehicle crashes. We handle those. Accidental asphyxiations, a kid choking. You know, we get all of those. So that really, no matter what state you go in, those are always going to be your two highest types of death or something in those categories. And a lot of those could be prevented. A lot of the accidentals can definitely be prevented. And then when you look at your homicide numbers and your suicide numbers, those typically drop down very, very dramatically. And then you have your undetermined category, which could just usually undetermined are because you either have too much information to call it something or you have too little information to call it something. And so they just can't, you can't pigeonhole them in one of the other four categories, so they end up as undetermined.
Well, I mean, like in adults, I mean, the medical examiner, obviously, of the categories of manners of death, natural is by far the most common. Is that true of children? And then can you give us kind of a feel for the percentages of the five different manners of death in children, what kind of percentage fall into each one?
I can just give you rough numbers for North
Carolina, exactly.
But what I see going across the country is it's very similar. It's very, very similar, and there's just a very set pattern to it. So for North Carolina, we might see 500 deaths a year, and when I say 500, those are medical examiner cases, and those are kids 17 years of age and under. So depending on what state you're in, you know, that age may differ. Usually it's around 17 or 18 and under. But so for us, in 1 year, we might see between 50 and 60 homicides. Our suicides right now are at an all-time high, which is very concerning to me. But they have usually been between 30 and 40. So, you know, there's 100 cases right there. Our accidentals will be at least 200 or higher. The naturals will be close to the accidentals, and then the undetermineds make up the rest. So a significant percentage of the cases, you know, probably maybe less than 25% are going to be suicides and homicides, and the rest of it are going to be naturals, accidentals, and undetermineds. So it's a pretty big gap.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like we're going into our break here, so we're going to ask you all to come back with us in a few minutes. We'll learn more about child death investigation with our guest, Lisa Mayhew.
everybody, and I'd like to talk to you about some upcoming releases that are out now. Arthur Barbara Petty delivers the first book in a new series called What Has Mother Done? The title itself suggests a riveting mystery wrapped up within a drama. Reviewers have agreed that Barbara penned a winner, so check out Amazon.com for more on What Has Mother Done by Barbara Petty. Five gripping new mysteries await you from publisher Camel Press: Stealing the Golden Dream, Due for Discard, and Split to Splinters are just a few of the wonderful books being published by Camel Press. Check out all their titles by visiting camelpress.com. The Thriller Master is back with a sequel. Yes, David Morrell releases Inspector of the Dead, which brings back character Thomas De Quincey. Murder as a Fine Art was the first book and was listed on several of the top lists in 2014. Now experience more of 1850s London and Inspector of the Dead. Go to davidmorrell.net for more information on these and all of his books. Kensington Kills. Well, not really, but their books sure do. And author Lisa Jackson, M. William Phelps, A.J. Tana, and more deliver explosive action and intrigue with every page. Make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information on these and every title they have to offer, and you won't be sorry. Suspense Theater comes alive with Amon Kabachnik. His Blood on the Stage books bring readers a wealth of material for lovers of the stage, says the Los Angeles Times. Check out Where Stories Come Alive and visit Amon Kabachnik for more information on all six of these titles. And that's AmonKabachnik.com. A century-old tale leads to a fortune in bandit gold. That's the adventure that Jack Farrell faces in his latest adventure, Murrayana Gold, by author William Nickel. This is the fourth book in the series. And visit William Nickel, that's two K's, EL.com for more information on this and the entire series.
After the break here again with our very special guest, Lisa Mayhew, on Crime and Science Radio. Again, today's show is called From the Cradle to the Court, Child Death Investigator Lisa Mayhew. So let's now get right back to it with our host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, Lisa, before the break, we were talking about the categories for the manner of child death. What are some of the ways that a death investigator can tell if a child's death is accidental or intentionally caused?
I think it starts first at the initial history that comes in with the case. You know, like if someone calls in a case to us and they say, hey, we're at a scene, we've got a two-month-old baby that was found unresponsive in bed between the parents. And automatically our minds start to go towards, okay, this might be some type of asphyxial death, so here's the things we need to get prepared for. Or, you know, if there's a – whenever there's a history of a fall, it's usually a pretty good indicator something's not going to go well with the rest of this day. They fell off the couch. They fell down the stairs. You know, something simple fall around the house makes all of us very nervous. When you get there, what are the parents saying? I try to tell people not to make too many judgments, because if you're not used to the grieving process that parents are in the middle of, there's so much guilt that they are feeling at the time. They have a tendency to say things that make law enforcement's radar go up. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll say things like, oh, my God, this is all my fault, or I didn't mean to do this, or, you know, I did this. And, of course, law enforcement's like, well, hang on, you know, what are you talking about? And it's most of it's parental guilt. I mean, obviously there's going to be cases where they did it, but a lot of it is just parental guilt because they did not save their child. So in their minds, this is all my fault because I didn't save them in the first place, or I allowed this to happen. And, you know, those may be completely natural deaths. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got to look at what's being said, what that initial history is, and then you get into your scene investigation, sleeping arrangements, was the child sleeping alone, with other people, and then you get into the reconstruction. The reconstructions are a gold mine. I mean, there's no investigator out there should not be doing reconstructions on their child death cases, because it really can give you the true picture of what's going on.
Hmm. So who kills children? Is this stranger danger, or is it all in the family?
All in the family. Hmm. All in the family primarily. I mean, there's stranger cases, but they seem to be the exception rather than the rule. One of the things that we do in North Carolina that I haven't come across many other states that do this yet, we track our homicides, and we do it through our Conference of District Attorney's office. And so they've got a resource prosecutor there who helps us run our homicide cases. This is just the child abuse homicides, but they run the child abuse homicides through the system. And so we track every piece of information we can about that homicide. So we've got information on the perpetrators, the relationship to the child, what they're charged with, what they're ultimately convicted of or plead to, and what their sentencing is. So we can chart that back to, you know, 1999, 2000, and most of what we see first is biological mom or biological dad. Mm-hmm. They're going to be the number one and number two. And they kind of flip-flop. They kind of go through phases where one is higher than the other. But then you add in male caretakers. So then you go down to might be mom's boyfriend, or it might be a stepfather. And then you kind of whittle down to other types of caretakers. But it's almost always someone who is a blood relative, or who is a guardian of some sort, or who is known to the child in some capacity. And then you get down to those rare cases where there's no connection whatsoever. And those are kind of just the rarities.
So this is another thing. Cases are not solved in 45 minutes, and they are not all caused by the, you know, there's not this huge population of killer weirdos out there.
No. I mean, that's the good news. I mean, I'm always looking at the glass half full, so that is the good news, is that your perpetrator is right there in front of you. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go very far to find them on these cases. They're not whodunits mm-hmm. like some of your adult cases are, so that's a difference. You know, you pretty much know who did it right out of the gate, but getting that conviction getting those child abuse homicides through that same judicial system definitely takes some weird twists and turns in the adult cases too.
So what factors increase the possibility of child death?
Oh, gosh. I think a lot of things play into it. You know, just looking at accidental deaths, you have a lot of lack of supervision. People just not paying attention, not watching their children. We are seeing an increase, of course, in the caretakers' use of prescription drugs. Mm-hmm. So that's something that investigators really have to be on the lookout for, is if you've got a drowning or you've got a kid that was hit by a car or you've got whatever, were your parents, were your caretakers under the influence of any prescription drugs at the time? It's just, you know, we're in a pill society, so it's something that is kind of covering a lot of territory these days. There's bad choices. There's just bad choices that people make, and something bad happens. You know, a good example is someone leaving kids in the care of other kids. So you leave young toddlers in the care of an 8- or a 10-year-old kid, and something bad happens. With the homicides, it's frustration. It's lack of experience. It's, you know, a kid doing something very benign that for whatever reason just snaps that person's last good nerve. We've had a couple of cases over the past couple of years where the perpetrator was gaming, and so they were in that, you know, 10, 12-hour marathon of gaming, and the toddler or baby just did something in the house to make noise or interrupt their concentration, and they ended up beating the kid to death. So, you know, I think that there's just a lot of factors that play into it. And, of course, we see a whole host of different things with the suicides. But
I'm getting homesick. I absolutely love the term snap that last good nerve. That is so Southern. I love it. I grew up with that. And I know exactly what you mean. And there's 90 different levels of that.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. and it's
you can be just a little miffed, or you can be absolutely homicidal.
There you go.
There you go.
And Southern women can snap that in a heartbeat, too, can't they?
Yes, they can. Well, bless your heart.
Well, and, you know, I think another piece is you have people with unrealistic expectations of kids.
Yeah.
So what a normal kid does and what a normal baby does shouldn't affect a normal person to any degree. But if it's someone who doesn't have the experience or know-how to know why they're doing it in the first place and how to fix it, then they're just not going to cope well with it at all.
So people who, you know, like friends, relatives, next-door neighbors, things like this, what kind of indicators or clues or tells can they see that might make them wonder or think that their child might be in danger?
I think one thing that people probably should pay attention to that they don't is isolation. You know, people who you may not see the kid a lot, or they've moved the family away, and no one is seeing the children a lot, I would question that. I think if the child starts to pop up with any kind of illnesses or injuries or things that just don't seem right, anything visibly that can be seen. I mean, the one thing about these caretakers, if they're abusing their kids, they're extremely adept at hiding it. So people in the immediate vicinity of this kid may not necessarily catch it. But I think when they do, they have an obligation to report. And in just about every state that I know of, everyone's a mandated reporter. And, you know, because one of the things that will really, really, really upset me on a case is, you know, we're knee-deep in the middle of a homicide investigation, and we'll find out that three different people had concerns about the kid, and nobody said anything to anybody. And I'm like, you know, this kid didn't need to die. If you had come forward and reported your concerns and done something, we might not be dealing with what we're dealing with right now. And, you know, so just anything out of the ordinary. One thing I tell folks to look for are changes in routines. You know, if the kid is missing school, if they're missing ball practice, if it's a church-going family and they're not going as regularly as they used to, some type of change in a very typical routine could be an indicator there's something going on with the family dynamic that's causing that disruption in the routine. And that's something that should probably be looked at closer.
Very good.
He recently sent me a fascinating study that was done by researchers who looked into women as killers of children. And this is like, as I've mentioned to you outside the show, it's sort of a pet peeve of mine that people assume only fathers kill children. Can you tell us more about that study?
Oh, it's phenomenal. It was done by the researchers at the Behavioral Analysis Unit at the FBI, and they started it years ago, and they went around to various states, and they actually came down to North Carolina and met with us. Unfortunately, we gave them quite a few cases to work to include in their study. They started looking out at maternal filicide, so women who kill their children. And the more that they got into it, the more branches the tree kind of grew. Mm. I think they had in their mind they were going to look at it from just one perspective. And then as they got into the cases just opened it up to a whole nother project, because they were just going to do a research article. And, you know, you got it. It's over 60 pages. It's a book now. So they had to put it out as an e-book because it just grew and grew and grew. And it's a phenomenal work, in my opinion, because it debunks the myth about women as killers. Because if a man kills their kid, well, he's just mad. He's just a piece of crap. You know, he's just an evil SOB or whatever you want to call him. If a woman kills her kid, everyone's initial reaction is, oh, she must be crazy, the poor woman. And that's the myth. You know, women are not mentally ill killers on their children. And this work just does a beautiful job of explaining why that isn't so. And then it takes it one step further and gives wonderful recommendations for detectives on interviewing and interrogation techniques of women. And it also gives a lot of recommendations for prosecutors who are prosecuting women as killers, because that's an even bigger obstacle, because you're going to have a jury of 12 people who's got to sit in judgment on a woman who killed her kid, and that is like a DA's worst nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to mention to our listeners that we, in addition to other links, that will help you learn more about this topic, we will put a link where you'll be able to read that study, because I guarantee you it will be an eye-opener for most of you.
It's a must-have. I've pushed it everywhere I can.
Well, what other misconceptions do people have about child killers?
I think the biggest problem that people face is the intent piece, that they couldn't possibly have meant to kill them, that they just wanted them to be quiet, or they wanted them to stop bothering them, or whatever it is. And so intent is a big issue, definitely in prosecuting the case, but just in understanding how it came about, because depending on what state you're in, intent can be defined in a lot of different ways. Like North Carolina statutes allow for inference, so you can infer force from the act. Well, if you're shaking your kid like a rag doll, then that's a knowing and intentional act, because you know in your mind that shaking them is a bad thing to do. So it just, you know, it really, that's the big hump I think that everybody runs into, is most people have in their mind that surely this person did not intend to kill them.
Is age a factor in child death? Are there ages at which more children are killed than, say, at other times in childhood?
Oh, yeah. And I think that age is something that you see across all of the mechanisms. But most of your child abuse homicides in most states are going to be of the kids under 4 years of age. And what we see in North Carolina is we'll fluctuate. Like 1 year, our infants under one might be higher than our toddlers in the 1 to 4 age category, and then the next year they might flip-flop a little bit. But most of them are going to be in that under 4 age range. You know, with accidental drownings, you definitely see patterns based on the age. So most of your accidental drownings are under 4s, under 2s, and they occur in tubs or pools. Your accidental asphyxiations follow a certain pattern based on the age of the decedent. So age is definitely a factor in what you see and how kids die. Like your teenagers, they're going to be high on the homicide end, suicide end, and accidental end because of motor vehicle crashes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that can also kind of guide your investigations is, okay, what, you know, what's the age of my kid and what was going on here with them?
Yeah, with teenagers, it's kind of the old cliche about what's the last thing a Southern male says? Here, hold my beer and watch this.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And nothing good follows that ever.
Well, you know.
Yeah. I think, gosh, that's true for everybody, though.
That's true. But it seems to be big in the South. Hold my beer and watch this,
dude. Yeah. My favorite famous last words was always, what duck? But, But there is something to that, isn't there, with in terms of brain development even and judgment,
right,
that that teenagers, you know, what seems like, you know, the kind of thing that an adult would say, what possessed you? There's just not that stop sign hasn't
right,
fully developed yet, physically even, right?
And
yeah,
as my mom
yeah,
would say, if Charlie put his head in the oven, would you do that too? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's a lot of the impulsivity that we
yeah,
see in a lot of these cases.
Yep. Well, speaking of age,
mm-hmm,
how many child murders are at the hands of other children? And, you know, what's some cases or situations that you found particularly perplexing?
You know, we've had a few. They're pretty small as far as
right,
numbers. But we definitely have had them over the years. We had an 8-year-old. I think the most bothersome one we had was a 5-year-old. And I think he is in sequestration in a therapeutic situation now because he's, I mean, according to the detectives on that one, they're like sociopaths. F5. He killed an infant, and that disturbed everybody greatly.
Wow.
These were really experienced detectives, and this kid rattled their cages. So, you know, it doesn't happen very, very often at all, but it certainly is not out of the realm of possibility.
Well, besides sociopathy, I mean, what are the other reasons that one child might do in another? I mean, obviously sociopathy's got to play a role in it, but what are some of the reasons that you think that children might harm other children?
You know, I don't know. I don't
yeah,
know that I can answer it. I think sometimes it's jealousy. Sometimes
right,
it's just they're angry over something. You know, what I see with kids today, and this is just totally my opinion, but I see a huge lack of, I think kids just have a lack of respect for things, whether it's things or people, but I don't even know if I can put it into words.
Yeah.
It just, they don't have, I just don't know that they have the same capacity to feel for someone else. I mean, I can blame it on technology because I hate technology, but I do think to a certain extent we're depersonalizing children because everything's done by devices and there's no personal interaction, and I think that takes away from your empathy, your ability to have empathy.
Besides that lack of personal contact when people do go to their devices, as it were, What about the content? Do you think you like TV and video games and some of these crazy things? I mean, do you believe? I mean, obviously you deal with this a lot. Do you believe that that has an effect? I know it's a very controversial and there's no real answer to it situation, but do you think that these things impact how children relate with one another and that
Absolutely.
Lead to these kinds of things?
Yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, we were seeing this years ago with wrestling deaths.
Yeah.
You know, and then they started the cage fighting, and there were a couple of cases around the country where, you know, these 10-year-old kids were had a backyard cage in their yard and were beating the snot out of each other, and what do you know, one of them breaks a neck. And, I mean, so I think the influence has been going on for years,
right.
But I think that the content has completely gotten out of control, and, it can't not influence them, really.
That's been my feeling, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you can show evidence and statistical data or not, it just can't not influence. I just don't see how.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I was talking to a prosecutor the other day, and, I won't name the video game, but it's a pretty popular video game. And I guess, and I didn't know this, but apparently it shows brutal, violent sex. And you have this brutal violence on this video game, and it's kids have it all over the country, so you know, it's affecting behavior. So yeah, I think it does, but it's not even the games, it's everything. You know, my TV is stuck on TV Land or Retro Television Network because I don't even like half of what's out there today, because it just doesn't, I don't know. I'd prefer to watch The Rifleman than anything else.
Oh, I love that show.
I know.
Well, another thing that sort of technology has influenced, we know, and there's no question about this, in terms of some of the kinds of bullying that goes on with social media, but children also commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Are there differences in child and adult suicide, and what are some of the indicators that a child may be thinking of suicide?
Oh, that's a great question. I do see differences. I think probably one of the primary differences is in the reason. So, you know, if you've got adult suicide, the reason's usually, financial ruin or divorce or they lost their job, or, you know, there's going to be a fairly big reason at the outset that everybody sees. With kids, the reasons are so commonplace that I think as adults we tend to overlook them because we just, in our mind, well, somebody would possibly kill themselves over that. And they do. And so, you know, I think we have to be cautious about reasons, though, because a lot of times you build your case based on the facts that you find, but the child may never have divulged why they killed themselves. So you may have a group of reasons that give you a good theory for suicide, but you may never know the true reason why they did it. So, we have categories, broad categories, and one of the ones that comes up about 50% of the time are relationship issues. And that might be romantic relationship issues, or that might be familial relationship issues.
Mm.
Then you have school issues, school issues could be anything from getting a bad grade on a test to getting kicked off of the school football team,
mm-hmm.
and everything in between. You know, family issues could be, who knows, they could be abuse, or it could be the family's moving and the kid doesn't want to leave that city or school or whatever. I think the problem that we have as adults is we underestimate kids, and we don't pay as much attention to the things that are right underneath our nose. And, we need to pay a little bit more attention. I think some of the things that people can see are, you know, these kids are isolating themselves for whatever reason, any kind of behavior change. I like looking at medications. We are medicating our kids way, way, way too much. And a lot of the ramifications of ADHD meds in combination with antidepressants or just antidepressants by themselves, a key risk factor is suicide in this age group. Mm-hmm. So, I think that that is a huge issue that we need to take a very, very tight look at. And it's just, it's hard during the investigation to get really good documentation on medications. We try really, really hard. But there's a few out there that really concern me that these kids are on. But it's just, you know, I think we just have to pay attention to what's going on with these kids. We're lucky in North Carolina. We haven't really had what I would consider like one of those true, nasty, bully side cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, my word of caution is bullying is such a buzzword now that when it, you know, it's like the first thing that comes out of people's mouths. But from an investigative standpoint, you either got to keep it on the table or kick it off. And a lot of the cases, it turns out to have nothing to do with bullying. It was something else. But everybody refers to it as being important. And so you have to rule it out. You've got to really do your homework and really rule it out. But, like one of our cases, the mother was the bully. It wasn't even happening at school. It was happening at home.
Wow.
So, I think they just have to take every case at face value and give it everything they've got.
Well, we, of course, would love to talk to you again because we're...
We have so much more to
talk about this much longer. We invite all of our listeners to go to crimeandscienceradio.com. You'll find more information about Lisa there, more information about child death investigation. Thank you so much, Lisa Mayhew, for being with us today.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.